Hola, Su. So, as many of you will recall, when one falls into the false facsimile of compassion, namely a kind of sense of hopelessness, despair, depression, grief, and so forth, then the antidote for that among the four immeasurables is what? Anybody know off the top of your head? Empathetic joy, yeah. So I thought before we go into the meditation, I'm going to give you some really nice bonbon. Something really, really nice, and it's true. From the news, it's rather hot item in the news today. There's a young woman from Pakistan. Some of you might know her name already. Her name is Malala Yousafzai. And she's one of the most remarkable women I've heard about in the modern era. She's just 16, lives out in the Swat Valley in Pakistan. And her father was and is a strong advocate of education for children, for girls in particular. And of course, he has one, and so he wanted to make very sure that his daughter got an education. But he not only made sure that he got an education, but he was really quite vocal about the importance of girls getting an education. And so she, at the age of 11, she's 16 now, she at the age of 11 thought, well, why should my father have all the responsibility for that? Why don't I start being an advocate for education for girls? Why don't I take this on? Why just leave it to him? And so from the age of 11, she found every podium, every medium that she possibly could find to be advocating, girls really have a right to education. We need this at the age of 11. Well, she made a name for herself, very articulate young lady, and she became more and more renowned for her very outspoken views, not militant, nothing aggressive, but just very straight, that this is a right. Until she became really very well known, and she was receiving death threats from the age of 14 or so, if I recall correctly. I don't have every precise detail, but starting to get death threats from the Taliban. And then 1 year ago, a group of Taliban stopped the bus on which she was being taken to school with, I think, maybe three other girls. They stopped the bus at gunpoint, came into the bus, and demanded of these little girls, which one of you is Malala? And the other little girls were terrified, of course. And they pointed to her. And then the Taliban came over to her at point-blank range and shot her in the head. And then they shot all the other girls as well. And she was 15. And then through just extraordinary care on the part of the Pakistani doctors of surgery, one surgery after another, and then she was taken to the UK. She survived, and I saw her. She looks perfectly good shape, and her mind's not damaged anything. She survived that. And she continues to advocate. Well, she's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, and she's the youngest person in history to be nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I saw her being interviewed just last night, and I was just tremendously moved. The Taliban, now she's 16, as I said, the Taliban has vowed that they will try to kill her again, so she's still on their hit list. And she was asked, what would you do if you're accosted again by the Taliban? And this is a direct quote from the 16-year-old young lady. If you hit... It's hard for me to speak, but it's from, actually, as you can tell, it's from joy. But I just find it tremendously meaningful and moving. If she says, if you hit a Talib, a person from the Taliban, then there would be no difference between you and the Talib. You must not treat others with cruelty. You must fight others through peace and through dialogue and through education. And she was asked a bit further. This is actually, of all places, it was on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, which is, you know, as they say, fake news. But he interviewed with tremendous sensitivity. And he pursued it. And I can't quote here, but I can give a very close paraphrase. He said, yeah, but what will you do if they come after you with a gun and they encounter you? What will you do? And she said, after having said this, right following that, she said, well, I will tell them that I hope that your daughters also get an education, because that's important for all of us. And now do what you will. So really, I just thought, oh gosh, if in any future life, this life or any future life, I could be a practitioner like that, then I'll really be a Dharma practitioner. And I really have no interest whatsoever. I presume she's Muslim, and I really don't care. I really don't care. It doesn't matter, right? So that's to start off the meditation. Okay? There are people out like that. There are people out there like that. And she has won tremendous admiration in Pakistan. She won a great prize in Pakistan, another award. She's inspiring people all over the world. You know, and she's 16. Now let's meditate. Let's settle the body, speech, and mind in the natural state. Calm the discursive mind with mindfulness of breathing, counting 21 times if you find it helpful. Now with your eyes closed, bring forth whatever understanding, whatever possible insight you might have into the emptiness of inherent nature of the entire phenomenal world. Withdraw your conceptual designations of objects, of the surrounding world, the conceptual designation of your own body and mind. Release all appearances and all objects. into the Dhamma Dhatu, the absolute space of phenomena, emptiness, and rest for a little while. In this vast expanse, free of objectivity. Then spontaneously, from this open space, without visualizing your body, simply where your heart is, the heart chakra, the center, visualize forming from this vast and pure space a radiant incandescent orb of white light, symbolizing your ground awareness, pristine awareness. Be that orb of light. View it from within. And imagine from this inexhaustible source, light rays emanating in all directions, permeating the whole of space. Such that the entirety of space is permeated by an equal purity, the primordial purity of pristine awareness. Space and awareness non-dual. Then invite in the blessings of the body, speech, and mind of all the enlightened ones, of the three times, of all the 10 directions. Imagine this light converging from all directions back into the orb at your heart, drawing in the blessings of all the Buddhas. Then, like a light projecting a holographic image, imagine your own form, but now a form that is empty, a form purely of light, with no material constituents, no substantiality, a pure form of light, in your form, but radiant white light. Drawing very consciously on your powers of imagination, knowing exactly what you're doing, imagine this embodiment to be a personification of the compassion of all the awakened ones, the very nature of Avalokiteshvara, a body of compassion, still with the orb of light at your heart. And on this basis, designate yourself as being of the very nature of Avalokiteshvara. We now venture into Vajrayana practice, taking the fruition of enlightenment as the path, and assume this identity on this basis, the very emptiness of your ordinary nature, and out of this vast purity of emptiness and primordial consciousness, yourself taking on this form. For just a little while, hold the visualization to the best of your ability, and even more importantly, sustain the flow of that sense of identity. It's called divine pride, identifying with your very core, your pristine awareness, taking the form, a pure form, your form, but purified, a transparent body of light. Then drawing on the power of prayer, with each in-breath, call upon the blessings of all the Buddhas. If you have a guru, call upon the blessings of the guru. If you have a yidam, be it Tara, Avalokiteshvara, Padmasambhava, whoever it may be, with each in-breath, invoke the blessings of all the Buddhas. You may swiftly realize the path, proceed along the path, come to the culmination of the path, that all obscuration may vanish and all qualities of the enlightened mind, speech and body may be realized. And with each in-breath, imagine the blessings of all the enlightened ones from all the directions converging in upon you from the space around, converging in upon you in the form of light, all converging in upon your body with each in-breath, the ultimate form of loving kindness for yourself, and with every out-breath, breathe out with the spirit of loving kindness. Breathe out this light from your heart in either of two ways. You may deliberately direct your attention to an individual, to a group of individuals, to humans, to non-humans, breathing out the light of loving kindness. With the aspiration, may you find the happiness you seek. May you cultivate its causes. Or you may simply leave your awareness open and see who comes to mind. And with every out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, and breath by breath, imagine those who come to mind finding the joy they seek, being freed of all obscurations, and achieving perfect awakening, breath by breath. Now release all visualizations and all aspirations, all activities of the mind. And let your awareness remain in stillness in its own nature, with no object. So, it's a variation on the theme of Tonglen, but it's more of taking in blessings and giving out the light of loving kindness rather than taking in suffering. They're both completely legitimate practices. And so we did a somewhat secularized version, not really secular, I mean, it had a whole transcendent dimension to it, but it hadn't formed into, I mean, a Christian could practice that, and it's the kingdom of heaven within, the Holy Spirit, and so forth. I mean, it would be exactly the same meditation. I don't know why a Muslim couldn't practice it, or a Jew, or anybody else. It was kind of left as like a stem cell, you know, a stem cell that could become Christian. Then you'd give it a bit more Christian terminology, or Jewish, or Hindu, and so forth and so on. So I wanted to start that way, to leave it wide open, that we've gone right to the essence without already formatting it in a way that is specific and unique to Buddhism. And of course, I'm saying that as a Buddhist. And tomorrow, what I'd like to do is share with you, the Avalokiteshvara meditation. It figures very prominently in this marvelous treatise. It's a masterpiece by Kame Chakme. I mentioned him earlier this morning. Quoted his book from the 17th century. He was actually a mentor or tutor, spiritual friend of the fifth Dalai Lama, the great fifth, back in the 17th century. And he taught this whole path with the preliminary practices. And then, of course, he teaches Shamatha Vipassana onto Mahamudra and Dzogchen, because it's the union of Mahamudra and Dzogchen. That was his great feat. I mean, he's not the only person who did it, but he's renowned for having done that. He did it, and so Gyatso Rinpoche taught me this text as I interpreted for him to many of his students, translated the text, translated his oral commentary, published in two volumes. But what I found so interesting, many, many things interesting, but one point about this text is immediately preceding, after doing the preliminary practices, classic, and Rinpoche said, never mind those, that's available all over the place. I won't teach that, Alan, you don't need to translate it. We'll just go right into what follows after the preliminary practices. And lo and behold, the first thing that was taught after a little bit of introduction was stage of generation practice. Stage of generation practice in Avalokiteshvara, the embodiment of enlightened compassion. And the author, Kame Chame Rinpoche, a great scholar, formidable scholar, as well as an accomplished adept, he really highlights this one and says, this is a public dharma that is normally for Vajrayana practice when you're doing what we just did, a type of self-generation, where you're adopting the sense of the divine pride yourself, imagining yourself as a deity. Normally, with hardly any exceptions, in order to be kind of authorized or empowered to do that, you must receive an empowerment from some lama who has received the lineage and so forth. But Kame Chame Rinpoche said, this is an exception. The Avalokiteshvara, this is public dharma. You can practice this with or without oral transmission, with or without empowerment. You can just practice it. This is free, open, Come one, come all. There is no possibility of harm here. So go for it, you know. And he wrote a whole chapter on this practice, all focusing around the Avalokiteshvara, all about compassion. And then having presented that, with very short, he gives a variety of very short sadhanas, very short kind of so guided meditations. And then when that's all finished, then he goes to shamatha. Like, before you start your shamatha, how about a great big barrel full of blessings, you know, to inspire you, to enrich you, to bring the warmth, the kindness, the loving kindness and compassion to your practice, that your whole practice of shamatha is nested in that, right? And then from shamatha to vipassana, from vipassana to mahamudra, and dzogchen, tekchu, tutgel, the highest levels, rainbow body, on to the, you know, to the stars and beyond. But it actually starts with Avalokiteshvara, after the preliminary practices. So I thought it's really quite splendid. And so I thought I would share that, kind of the quintessence of that with you tomorrow. Okay? That'll be Buddhist. That is the form, the symbolism and so forth. It's Avalokiteshvara. But today, after going kind of through the, how do you say, the first two noble truths of the 20th and 21st century, actually the latter part of the 19th as well, it was pretty grim from my perspective. It disturbs the mind to reflect upon these things. Now, if I said something false, then that's disturbance for a bad reason. But if what I said, and I was doing my very best to say truth all the way along, if I said something false, well, then I apologize. I don't know what it was, but I did. It certainly arouses passions, that's for sure. But I think sometimes passions are not such a necessary thing as long as it's not with the intention to harm. So, but in that preface, and we're going to go into the third and fourth noble truths today for the modern world. But I made two statements over the last couple of days that could look like they're completely contradictory, and I'd like to, it was kind of thesis, antithesis, and I'd like to do a synthesis. I said on the one hand, an obvious truth, I think, and that is if we look from, let's say, the time of Darwin, so more or less the mid part of the 19th century up to today, and that's 150 years, almost to the year, for that 150-year period, from the mid-19th century till now, in terms of the growth of human knowledge of the natural world, so by way of science, of course, what we've learned, I think it's a safe statement, that what we've learned in the last 150 years is more than we've learned in all the preceding centuries by way of the scientific study of the objective, physical, quantifiable world. It's absolutely staggering. The success of natural sciences, especially over this last 150 years, is just absolutely amazing. And of course, the benefits from it. It's not just a bunch of egghead knowledge. The technology, the medicine, the fact that this girl could survive, point blank, right in the head, in her head and her neck. And she comes out and I saw her. She looked fine, a little, maybe a little thing with her lip, but maybe she had it was kind of cute, you know, she had lip coming a little bit. Maybe she had it already. Maybe that's a tiny vestige of a bullet going through her brain. So, boy, if it weren't for the progress of modern science, technology, medicine for the last 50 years, 150 years, there's just no question she'd be dead. A beautiful human being would be dead at the age of 15. And here it is 1 year later, and she's fine. It's amazing. So really, I hope you've seen I've been celebrating science all along. So that's 150 years. There it is. But I also said something very weird that is anomalous, maybe a bit rattling to some people. And that is for exactly those same 150 years, we've been living in a dark age. You say, wait a minute, you can't say both. That doesn't work. Fantastic growth of knowledge, but living in dark. I'm saying, get your act together. Don't you remember what you said? I remember what I said. This fantastic growth of knowledge is for the objective, physical, quantifiable world. There is no comparable growth of knowledge. The nature of mental events, how the mind and body interact with each other. What is our capacity for compassion? What is our capacity for developing sustained attention? What is our capacity for developing equilibrium? Are there multiple dimensions to the mind? What's the nature of consciousness? What causes consciousness? Does it have multiple dimensions? What is the nature of genuine happiness? What are the root causes of suffering, specifically mental suffering? I just gave a whole bunch of questions which there are no answers from the last 150 years. They've left us in the dark. But it's not just ignorance, it's delusion. Because there's a reason we're in the dark, and that's because of this massive weight of metaphysical assumptions that refuses to ask the questions because they don't know how to answer them, so they just jump to illusions of knowledge. And that's this metaphysical burden, the baggage, the straitjacket of the beliefs of scientific materialism. And so that's what I'm saying, that we've had this tremendous asymmetry of this extraordinary growth of knowledge, but it's all outer. And then we turn the inner into outer. So the inner should be where you are. Your emotions, your thoughts, your mind is over there. They say, oh, screw that. It's the brain. Your inner is outer. There is no inner. You're an it. Oh, man, I'm starting to feel ill again, you know? So that's what I was referring to, that it's brilliant and it's tragic. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Charles Dickens, The Tale of Two Civilizations, you know? But one indicator of this, that maybe this isn't just wild speculation, is if you look at exactly that same 150 years where there's an undeniable growth of knowledge of fantastic proportions about the human body, the brain, and every branch of the natural sciences, we have grown so much in knowledge and understanding. It's extraordinary, right? And yet if we look at that same period of knowledge, the same period of time of history, 150 years, we'll see during exactly that same 150 years, that historical period, we've done more damage to the natural environment than we have in all the preceding centuries and millennia of human existence. Everything up to 1850, and then from then, look at the damage. There's no comparison. We've done infinitely more damage. I mean, not infinitely, but massively more damage to the natural environment, to the air, the global warming, the water, the oceans, the soil, the everything. We have screwed up our environment unbelievably, you know. In the same time when we've learned so much about it, you think, wait a minute, that's impossible. You've learned so much, of course you're going to treat it better because now you understand it much better. No, we treat it much worse. So there's one, desecration of the natural environment, like there's no tomorrow, and there may not be. Second, extermination of other species. It's going on at the rate of, I don't know, 200 a year. It's a staggering rate right now in 2013. How many other species? We're just methodically wiping out, and it's been going on more or less that same period. There's nothing to compare it to prior to the mid-19th century. More species wiped out in this 150 years than all the preceding centuries put together, right? And then finally this one, where it really comes home. This is the last negative point. This is the second noble truth of the modern era. And that is, look at the last 150 years. Man's inhumanity to man. When have we ever done this type of damage? We can look at Nazis, of course. We can look at Stalin, killed 20 million of his own people. Mao Zedong killed maybe 40 to 60 million of his own people. The genocide, the ethnic cleansing, the brutality of human beings to human beings, the number of people, the First World War, the Second World War, nuclear war, the massive growth of weapons of mass destruction in the same period. It's kind of like we're just going crazy, like we just decided humanity wants to kill itself in the same period that we've learned so much. How is that possible? How is that possible? Well, I think it's possible because this is tremendous asymmetry in the growth of knowledge. So those are the first two noble truths. Is there any possibility of balancing this out? And of course, if there weren't, then I would not have given the lectures the last 2 days. I say, then I just want to bum you out. I don't want to be upset. I'd like to talk about happy things myself, right? So, and the Buddha himself, he would never have talked about the first two noble truths and ruined everybody's day. You know, I mean, what so-called world religion talks more about suffering? 6 types of suffering, 3 types of suffering, 8 types of suffering. You know, who talked about suffering more than the Buddha? If this is the opium of the people, he got some really bad dope. This is not an escape from reality. This is like, please, not quite so much reality. I think I've had enough already. But he would never have gone into that elaborate discussion of 84,000 mental afflictions in all these multiple, the ocean of samsara and so forth, if there weren't the second two noble truths. There's a possibility of freedom, and here's a path. You know the word again, path. So, I have nothing to add to the Buddha. What would I am? It's ridiculous, you know? But perhaps something to add to Buddhism in the 21st century, because there are unprecedented causes of suffering in our century that weren't there in the early part of the 19th century, and the 17th century, and the 16th. They weren't there. Scientific materialism was the ideas of a few nutcases, a few weird people here and there. But hardly anybody believed that. It's so silly. It's foolishness. It's idiocy. But now it's become common coinage. So moving ahead now. Now it's entirely moving ahead, and hopefully by tomorrow then we can get back to this more kind of primordial dharma that's not just simply, addressing 21st century issues. And as you might have anticipated, I'm coming back to William James. Now, he's responding directly to that statement by the 19th century British philosopher and mathematician who said, it is always, everywhere, and for everybody wrong to believe without conclusive evidence. You remember it well. Here's his response to that. Okay, so now we're just picking up. This is William James in dialogue with him because he quoted him. And then I quoted William James quoting him. So here's William James's response to that statement, which we see, of course, science have never followed, and nobody, nor does anybody else. And that statement itself is a violation of what it's saying. So I've already analyzed that. Here's what William James says. And that is, where preferences are powerless to modify or produce things, faith is totally inappropriate. But for the class of truths that depend on personal preference, trust, or loyalty, for actualization. I'm going to read that again. There's a whole class of truths with respect to which faith is just inappropriate. I mean, stop. So, for example, having faith, you know, if you're running an experiment, you're trying to figure out whether gravity, whether it's an inverse square law, inverse cube law, and having faith, having a preference, praying that, oh, may it be inverse cube law. Oh, give it a break, you know. There's something that's true, and it doesn't matter what you prefer, what you hope, and so forth. Just find out what it is and drop all your biases and see what it is. So there's many things like that, right? At what temperature does water freeze? Oh, may it freeze at 40 degrees? Oh, stop, you know. It's just, there's a whole realm of truths where there's faith, preferences, wishing, praying, and so forth. Oh, give it a break, you know. But there is another class of truths that depend on personal preference, trust, or loyalty for actualization. That are they're truths, but they haven't been actualized. They are truths in the realm of possibility, right? Because there are two realms, right? This is not hocus pocus, airy fairy. This is not everything that's real is real already. It's in that superposition state. It's a possibility. It is really a possibility. It's a truth as a possibility. There are possibilities. Possibilities are real, right? Otherwise, nothing would ever change. And so we have a realm of possibility. We have a realm of actuality. But within the realm of possibility, there are some things that will not become actual without preference. Well, how about the placebo effect? If you don't have faith, if you don't have expectation, you don't have trust, confidence, and so forth, you're not going to get a placebo effect. In which case, you could have been healed, but you weren't. It was possible, but then it didn't actualize. Right? In those cases, faith is a reality maker. And that's what William James saw. And he wasn't a religious person. It's so amazing. He's, I think, really one of the most unbiased people in the modern intellectual history. Totally sympathetic to religion and wasn't religious. Not Buddhist, Christian, or anything else. Profoundly scientific, but didn't buy into scientific materialism. So see, for that class of truths that do depend on personal preference, trust, or loyalty for actualization, and I quote, faith is not only licit, that is, allowable, okay, and pertinent, that is relevant, but essential and indispensable. So he's throwing it right back in the face of that fellow that said never and under and nowhere, never, 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 never believe without compelling evidence, sufficient evidence. He's saying, that's just false. You're wrong. And of course, he's wrong in so many ways. It's hard to count them. He says it's essential and indispensable, faith is. Such truths, now get this, such truths cannot become true till our faith has made them so. I think that's simply true. I think it's obviously true. The placebo effect. It doesn't work always, but it works so many times that hundreds of millions of dollars are spent every year to try to knock it out because it's not marketable. So you can sell your drug and say, this isn't because of the placebo effect, right? But of course, it's not just the placebo effect. There are some truths that cannot become true till our faith has made them so. Well, how about this one? Now that I went on, perhaps upsetting some people, I hope not, but if they upset, maybe it's for good reason. This morning when I was very critical of the, shall I say mildly, underemphasis on shamatha, on vipassana, on really encouraging people to reach the path, whether it's the small stage of the Mahamudra yoga of single-pointed yoga, whether it's the Mahayana path of accumulation, and so forth. That if you don't believe it's true, if you don't think it's possible anymore, and there are quite a few Buddhist teachers who don't think it's possible anymore. I've heard them say it. It's not speculation. No, no, this is a degenerate time. We can't really, it's not, it's hopeless. Things are too bad now. It's too degenerate. We can no longer achieve such realization. Well, if there's ever a self-fulfilling prophecy, that is one. If you don't believe it's possible, then it's not possible for you. And if you have students, and that's just what you've told them, just, you know, live, practice virtue, get a lot of good imprints, recite mantras, make good prayers of dedication. But of course, you really won't achieve anything in this lifetime, so don't get your hopes up. Well, then you've just stepped on your students. You've squashed them flat. Because now it's pretty much guaranteed they won't. As long as they're following you, they won't. Because you've just not only not given them any hope, you've flattened their hope. That's a spiritual teacher? I think that's an anti-spiritual teacher, isn't it? I've heard people say that. And they regard themselves as, you know, Dharma teachers. So William James has a very profound analysis of that. Is it possible to achieve shamatha? I'm sure that thought has popped up in your mind on occasion. Is it possible for a person like you, or you, or where somebody a little bit, or you, with gray hair, you know, like me, is it possible for old fogies like us to achieve shamatha? Or maybe only, maybe Camilla, maybe Carmen, maybe the really youngest ones here. Is it possible or not? It's a good question. If you think, I doubt it, well, congratulations, you're right. If you think, no way, you're right. If you think, maybe, you're right. If you think, yes, I think I can, you're right. It's one of those things right now in the realm of possibility. But if you don't believe it, it ain't going to happen. So let's continue. This is a vision. I've been sharing a lot of visions, and a vision is a view, right? A way of viewing a reality. A vision is a way of viewing something in the realm of possibility that could become actuality. That's a vision, isn't it? I have a vision. When Martin Luther King says, I have a dream, well, he's saying, I have a vision. I have a vision. He was not seeing it. This kind of color blindedness, you know, total absence of racism in the United States in 1963, wasn't it? Well, that wasn't there. I mean, there was an enormous amount of racism in the United States in 1963 and then all the preceding centuries that there was a United States. But he said, I have a dream. Well, he said, I have a vision of something that's not true now, but it could be. And if we focus on that vision, and if we speak about it passionately, and if we denounce with vehemence but nonviolence that which is antithetical to his vision, racism, then we will overcome. We will overcome. No vision, no change. No vision, it's status quo. No vision, you're stuck. You are doing the opposite of an expedition. You are stuck in the ruts, right? So what does William James have to say about visions? In what manner, he says, I quote, in what manner do we espouse, that is articulate, promote, and hold fast to visions? And then he answers this question. By thinking a conception might be true somewhere, like, has anybody achieved shamatha? The answer is yes. Yang Tan Rinpoche, that's just for starters. And that's just one of my teachers. How many more? I don't know. But at least one, certainly more, of my teachers. So is it might it be true somewhere? By thinking a conception might be true somewhere, hold that, it may be true here, even here and now. Is it possible here, now? It is fit to be true. And it ought to be true, it must be true, it shall be true for me. I like that. Tibetans call that semshuk, strength of your heart. You hold a vision and you believe in it. And if you don't have any corroborating evidence, well then, make some. Don't look around for it. You might be wandering all over the globe. Have you achieved shamatha? Have you achieved shamatha? And even those who have since, no. Even those who have probably won't tell you. That's not their business to try to persuade you because of what they've done. Persuade you by developing your own evidence. That's what this 8 weeks is for, not to achieve shamatha, but to develop confidence. that you see you can move from stage one to two, at least on occasion, which means you're not hardwired for rumination, coarse excitation, and dullness. And if you're not hardwired, then why couldn't you go from stage two to three? And if you had perseverance, conducive circumstances, all of that, then why not? That's the real question. And it's not for me to persuade you or for me to do some song and dance here or impress you by me. What a waste of time. Impress yourself. That you take home with you. I'm going to read it again. How do we espouse and hold fast to visions? By thinking a conception might be true somewhere. It may be true here, even here and now. It is fit to be true, and it ought to be true. It must be true. It shall be true for me. I've got a great story now. And I checked it out to see if I could get it as accurate as possible. And it has to do with Thomas Edison, the great American inventor, one of the greatest inventors of modern history. When queried about his many unsuccessful attempts to invent an electric light bulb, he was being interviewed by a reporter from the New York Times. When queried about that, you know, you've been trying and trying and trying, and you have not succeeded, said the journalist to Thomas Edison. Thomas Edison responded to him when he said, the guy said, 700 times, I've heard you've run 700 trials to create an electric light bulb, and they've all failed. Why don't you give up? It's not working. Something like that. This would be a close paraphrase of what he said, because now we'll see what Thomas Edison said about his 700 failures, and why not give up? It's not working, probably impossible. Thomas Edison responded, I have not failed 700 times. I have not failed once. I have succeeded in proving that those 700 ways will not work. When I have eliminated the ways that will not work, I will find the way that will work. So a number of you have found at least 70, if not 700 ways, 700 ways not to achieve shamatha. And counting. But as you do that, by a process of elimination, when you have eliminated all the ways not to achieve shamatha, there will be one thing left over. And that's the way to achieve shamatha, and then you can achieve shamatha. Thomas Edison, a light bulb, you, enlightenment. Or the the natural luminosity of your substrate consciousness, which is always there. Oh yes, I am a cute guy, aren't I? And here's just one follow-up from Thomas Edison. This really got to me too. Many of life's failures, heavy word, right? Many of life's failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they gave up. Got it? So we move on. William James. Now, responding to philosophy, which we think a lot of people kind of egghead all reason, rationality, and so forth, he said, philosophy is more a matter of passionate vision than of logic. Logic only finding reasons for the vision afterwards. So there's a role for passion. He knew all about that. And people, we're moved by passions, and not just mental affliction. We're moved by vision. Martin Luther King moved by passion. His Holiness Dalai Lama is moved by passion. If I think all of you have probably seen him, at least in documentaries and so forth. He's not a bland, milk toast kind of like that kind of person. I mean, there's an enormous amount of passion there, right? As far as I can tell, it's all virtuous, but it's undeniably passion. And I've seen him weep on multiple occasions. That comes from his passion too. So now let's come back, hone in on the really kind of the nucleus of the dark ages we've been in for the last 150 years and the way out, the way to get the paper bag off our heads. And we come back to a definition of psychology. And the antidote really is actually science. It's not something Buddhist science or something esoteric or, wow, how could anybody think of that? It's actually coming back to the principles of science that have been so blatantly ignored for the last 150 years when it comes to the study of the mind. But let's just start with a definition. What's psychology? Because until the 1875 or so, there was no empirical experimental science of the mind. There wasn't any. There are a lot of people who thought about it a lot. They wrote a lot of books about it. But experimental psychology, like what we've been doing here, we've been running all kinds of experiments, right? But it didn't exist until William James and Wilhelm Wundt in Germany. So William James defined psychology. He said, psychology is the science of mental life, both of its phenomena, your actual experiences and their conditions. That means your brain, your environment, your diet, genetics, and all of that, everything that contributes to it. But then, of course, the nucleus is your experience itself of having a mind. And that's psychology. It's a study of that. I think that is an eminently sensible, truly empirical, totally scientific definition that, of course, the behaviorist put in the trash and put in the toilet and flushed. So core to this, core to developing this psychology of the science as a science of mental life, then what he adamantly, vehemently, and passionately promoted was, let us now be truly empirical, that is, look at the phenomena, look at the experience, and not just things correlated to the experience of having a mind, like brain and behavior. And what he spoke of is radical empiricism, and this is what he meant by that. I say empiricism, in quotation marks, because it is contented to regard its most assured conclusions concerning matters of fact as hypotheses liable to modification in the course of future experience. In other words, empiricism is just the opposite of dogmatism. Whatever conclusions you've drawn, life emerges from inorganic matter. The mind is produced by the brain. I just read Richard Dawkins saying, universal love and unconditional love, impossible because it's not biologically adaptive. And we're animals, so give up on it. Don't even try. That's Richard Dawkins, okay? That's a hypothesis. Okay? So, well, just whatever your conclusions are, based upon all your worldview and so forth, all of your conclusions, these are liable. Consider that they are, even your most assured ones, like absolute space and time, like the conservation of mass energy, or the ether, or that the mind is the brain, issues for which many people have no doubts whatsoever, your most assured conclusions, regard them as hypotheses liable to modification in the course of future experience. In other words, you're open. That's empiricism. And I say radical because it treats the doctrine of monism, and what he's referring to, I know the context, monism is what he calls materialistic monism. Everything boils down to one thing, matter and its emergent properties. That's monism. Okay, scientific materialism, which is endemic at his time. He said, it treats the doctrine of monism itself as a hypothesis, not an unquestionable truth, which is, again, so widespread in modern science. And unlike so much of the halfway empiricism, we'll look at experiences, but not that kind of experience, right? We won't look at any experience that might violate or even question our assumptions. That's halfway empiricism. Right? That's what he's referring to as halfway empiricism. Parapsychology, no, we don't look at that. Experience of a past life, no, we don't look at that. Experience of continuity of experience after brain death, no, we don't look at that. Placebo effect, don't ask the question. Activity of neurons, yes. Activity of dendrites, activity of yes. But no. In other words, we'll look at the experience only that is compatible with our beliefs, but we'll ignore any kind of evidence that's incompatible with our beliefs. That's halfway empiricism. He says, no, I mean radical. I mean you are open to, that is, you are without bias, you are open to and closely attentive to all types of experience. And he says, unlike so much of the halfway empiricism that is current under the names of positivism or agnosticism or scientific naturalism, which I've been calling scientific materialism, it does not dogmatically affirm monism as something with which all experience has got to square. That's William James's response to Neil Tyson, the astronomer, that said, your experience doesn't count. To Michael Shermer, that said, your experience doesn't count. It's the lowest form. To Ann Treisman, that said, your experience is all hallucination. To Robert Scharf, that said, all of your experience, it's little mindless, worthless wigglings that go nowhere at all. That's his response to all the anti-empiricists. There it is, right there. And so what he's doing is he's taking out Occam's razor that was rusting in the drawer for about 100 years, or at least 50 years at his time, Occam's razor. This is how science in the modern world got launched, by scraping off the baggage of uncorroborated assumptions that allowed Galileo to ask questions, Copernicus to ask questions, that contradicted assumptions that had been unquestioned for many, many centuries. Since the second century at least. And so Occam's razor is simply very simple. It is vain, said Occam's razor, the principle is. This is a medieval philosopher, and this principle was used mightily with the rise of modern science, which questions so many of the assumptions of the literal reading of the Bible and of Aristotle and the other Greek philosophers. Occam's razor of the principle is, it is vain to do with more assumptions what can be done with fewer assumptions. In other words, have as few assumptions as possible and really let everything be evidence-based. So we're kind of going back to that British philosopher-mathematician, let it be evidence-based, but be open to all kinds of evidence and not just the preferred types of evidence. And all your assumptions, oh, there cannot be causal interaction between the mind and the brain if the mind is non-physical, because I can't imagine it. That's an assumption. Throw it out. Just put it over here on the side. Maybe it's true, but that's baggage, because you don't know whether that's true or not. And there are so many others as well. So I remember having a debate when it was at Columbia University at a conference years ago with my friend, Owen Flanagan, who's a very, very committed materialist. And I kind of teased him a little bit. We've known each other for years. He's got a nice bushy beard. And I said, Owen, why don't you take a razor and shave off the beard of all your materialistic assumptions? And why don't we just deal with the scientific facts? That we don't know the nature of the correlations. We don't know whether the mind is a function of the brain. We don't know the nature of consciousness or what causes. Why don't we just shave off? Why don't you just shave off all those assumptions? Because they're not helping you. They're not science. They're not evidence-based. They're just the baggage you're bringing to it. Why don't you shave that off? And he smiled and no thank you. He's kept his beard. I say this with affection, but we certainly do differ very deeply in our views. And so how do you pursue then the spirit of radical empiricism, which is radical anti-dogmatism? Because you see, he's not promoting, and by the way, this is my view. He said, no. Check. Be open to all experience and do so critically in a scientific spirit. So how do you apply radical empiricism to studying the mind, the life of the mind, your emotions, thoughts, desires, all states of consciousness, mental processes, dreams, altered states of consciousness, paranormal, if there are paranormal, psychic abilities or psych, how do you study that? Well, you go to the core, and he said here, in his vision, and that's what it is, his vision of a radically empirical psychology. In that context, how do you proceed? What's your methodology? And he said, introspective observation is what we have to rely on first and foremost and always. The word introspection need hardly be defined. It means, of course, the looking into our minds, into our own minds, and reporting what we there discover. And then in italics, everyone agrees that we there discover states of consciousness. So he acknowledged elsewhere, of course, the study of behavior that's coming from our mental states and processes. Of course, we study the brain and the neurocorrelates, the mental, of course. But first, foremost, and always, like every other branch of natural science, your primary mode of investigation is to observe the phenomena you're trying to understand. The only way you can observe mental events, mental phenomena, states of consciousness, is through introspection, because no system of measurement of technology can measure any subjective state whatsoever. You know? And so introspection should be first, foremost, and always. And then let behavioral studies and neuroscientific studies augment, fill out, give a three-dimensionality, because that's studying the conditions that give rise to states of consciousness. And of course, it shows the efficacy of states of consciousness by way of behavior. So it was rich, it was rounded, completely without bias, open, and completely ignored. From the rise of behaviorism in 1910, buried. Nobody's followed that. Nobody's followed that. They have buildings like at Harvard, the William James Building. The William James, that's the building, that's the name of the building for psychology. Nobody there practices this. Nobody there practices it. Show me a major university in the world where they're actually following William James. He's one of those people, everybody, you know, neuroscience, psychology, oh, William James, the great William James. They don't follow him. Nowhere. Okay? So, but then what about introspection? Wait a minute, it's subjective, it's fallible, you know, it's prone to prejudice and preconceptions and so forth. It's really problematic. Are you aware of that? Oh, he was no dummy. This is what he said about introspection. Introspection is difficult and fallible. And the difficulty is simply that of all observation of whatever kind. And that is, let's step back to Anne Treisman. She's done an amazing amount of research on attention and many, many, many types of optical illusions. She showed a whole slew of them in her presentation at this Mind and Life conference. And just showing how many, many times we're deceived by appearances, you know. And that's primarily visual. Again, we're 80% ocular, but also auditory, and so forth. And of course, those appearances don't exist out there objectively, absolutely objective world. And they appear to be, so in that way, they are delusive, they're misleading. And then introspective awareness. Of course, what he's saying here is that introspection, yeah, it's fallible, it's difficult. But, oh, by the way, all of our experiences of the world, they're also fallible, right? Your visual perceptions, your auditory and so forth, they're fallible. And, oh, by the way, Mr. Tyson and Mr. Shermer and so forth, scientific observations are also fallible. Have you been watching for the last 400 years? How many false measurements, how many false conclusions, how many times your technology goes screwy and you get false data, or you interpret them falsely. Have you noticed that scientists are not immune from this? We're all prone to this. Any type of measurement, whether it's done with technology, with your eyes, your ears, or introspectively, they're all fallible, they're all difficult if they're sophisticated. So there's nothing special about introspection, that it's somehow uniquely and intrinsically fallible, intrinsically misleading. They're all misleading. All the appearances seem to be out there. They're not. But then why don't you ask the second question? If they're not out there, where are they? You say they're in the brain? Good, show me some evidence. Show me the image of your mom in your brain. I'd really like to see that. Hi, Mom. I don't think you'll find that. I think you'll find neurons and other cells. So he says introspection is difficult and fallible. And the difficulty is simply that of all observation of whatever kind. The only safeguard is, I lost my screen, in the final consensus of our farther knowledge. By farther here means our later knowledge. That is, continuing the research. It's in the final consensus where there is consensus, where there's, you experienced that, so did I. Oh, you did too, and you did. You all did? Okay, like mathematicians saying, yeah, that really is a proof. It's entirely internal. You can't tell from outside whether something's a proof. It's in the minds of the mathematicians, right? And then they, well-trained mathematicians, they say, this is a brilliant proof. People aren't mathematicians. They don't have a clue. But the mathematicians, if they're well-trained and they scrutinize this, oh, that's a brilliant proof. I've never seen that proof before. They all know it. It's by process of consensus. And it's entirely subjective. Well, now you've been practicing at least 5 weeks these various forms of shamatha. I'm not going to run this experiment right now, but I could make a list of questions and say, what are your conclusions based on your experience? Have you come to any consensus, or are you all having totally different experiences? I think we'd have a long list just in 5 weeks. This is a preliminary to professional training. This is not professional training. This is preliminary professional training, like an undergraduate degree, 4 years, graduate degree, another 6 years. That's professional training. That's what we need contemplative observatories for. But even in 5 weeks, I don't think anybody here doubts that there's a lot of consensus about discoveries you've made, experiences you've had, that you've had individually, but it turns out many other people have as well. There's a lot of consensual knowledge in 5 weeks, right? So that's what he's saying. You get consensus as you continue to probe and probe and probe. The only safeguard is in the final consensus of our farther knowledge about the thing in question, later views correcting earlier ones, until at last the harmony of a consistent system is reached. He just described the history of science. You make an observation, but somebody else comes up with a better telescope or a better microscope or a more sophisticated observation, and they correct yours, like ether was believed, until Michelson-Morley said, sorry, but that doesn't work. And now finally they got over it, and now nobody believes in ether. And continuing to make better and better, and then consensus happening again and again, that is the key right there to the growth of scientific knowledge. Making the observations, making better observations, getting together, replicating observations, coming to consensus, building on consensus, then going to the next horizon, sharper, more difficult. 40 years ago, we couldn't ask the question, are there planets around other stars? I mean, you can ask it, you get no answer. You can just say, oh, I suspect so, or no, I doubt so. That's all you could come up with. But the technology got better. The mathematics is really needed. It's superb. And now there's broad consensus. I don't know anybody who seriously doubts, but you couldn't do that 50 years ago. 100 years ago, if you asked, are there other galaxies in the universe? Maybe, maybe not. Nobody knew. They didn't have the technology. But they built one up above my hometown, the 100-inch telescope there in Mount Wilson. And then Hubble, looking through it, found 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 other galaxies. And now we know there are 100 billion. Right? You keep on making better observations, you find consensus, and then you have this growth of consensual knowledge. Fantastic. He's suggesting do the same thing for the science of the mind. That's truly radically empirical. It's brilliant. But it hadn't happened during his time. And so he writes, psychology indeed is today hardly more than what physics was before Galileo. Before Galileo, the type of, it's not kind of day and night or night and day, dark ages, and then there was Galileo. But there's nothing quite like Galileo in terms of both using the telescope, but he ran a number of really brilliant experiments using his technology he devised to determine whether, a big rock and a little rock actually hit the ground at the same time when you drop them off the Tower of Pisa, whether balls rolling down a ramp go at constant velocity or they accelerate. Everybody knew what they did because Aristotle said the big rock drops faster and the balls rolling down a ramp go at constant velocity. Everybody knew that, but nobody had measured it. It was just a big fat assumption. He came up with the technology and overthrew 2,000 years of assumption. He was a scientist. And then that was corroborated and corroborated. And then they built on that with Kepler. They built on that with Newton. They built on that, building on that ever since. But before him, with a few exceptions like Tycho Brahe in Denmark and so on, astronomy was folk astronomy. It was naked eye. You see 3,000 dots up there in the sky and that's it. They had no, for astronomy itself, they had no sophisticated means of observing the phenomena at all. And then we say, okay, if we say introspection is like the telescope for the mind, stable, clear, highly focused, well, in the year 2013, introspection is still not used in any major university that I know of as a means of rigorously investigating the nature of mental phenomena. And I know one psychologist who's the chair of a psychology department at a major university, and he's a Zen practitioner. And he tried to introduce a bit of introspection into the department, saying, look, we should actually be looking at mental phenomena, don't you think? We're psychologists. And he's a chair, so he's trying to persuade his fellow faculty members, why don't we introduce a bit of trained introspection into the curriculum? And they voted him down, flat. No thanks. Don't need that. That's not scientific. They wouldn't let him do it. So here we are. Psychology today in 2013, this is more than 100 years since he said that, is to the study of the mind what physics was before Galileo in some very important ways. Like, you're not even looking at the phenomena in a sophisticated way because they're not physical, objective, and quantifiable. But now he brings us over to the area that I've studied professionally, my PhD is in religious studies. What about religion? Because we have experiences of the ordinary mind. Our emotions, desires, attention, the stuff that happens in the coarse mind, the ordinary mind, which we have the logia of the psyche. Okay, that's good. Logia of the psyche, psychology, is studying the ordinary mind. Good, that should be studied, right? But what about religion? In his brilliant book, Varieties of Religious Experience, it's amazing, it's still a classic. I studied carefully. And he's going into, of course, he's not going into religious dogma and institutions and corruption and witch hunts and so forth. Other people have done that. Let's go into religious experience. What do religious people experience as religious people? Let's study that as a psychologist, as a philosopher. And in that context, taking seriously religious experience, which, of course, as I read account after account, including by a Buddhist studies scholar, people won't touch. In religious studies, they hardly touch it. They'll only read about other people's books about it. They won't touch it, And so what does he say about that? He said, let empiricism, which he's just defined, become associated with religion. Let it finally become associated with religion as hitherto, until now, through some strange misunderstanding, empiricism has been associated with irreligion. So just like Thomas Spratt, remember him? Thomas Spratt, trying to get into the Royal Society. He said, what did he say? Experimental philosophy, mechanical philosophy, in other words, science, this is about empiricism, about evidence-based, drawing conclusions. Religion, that's about simple belief, simple faith. No empiricism needed, no experience needed. If you're looking for a job description, no experience needed. Just believe, just have faith. Blind faith is preferable. So this radical split, and then we have all the theologians, then writing tomes and tomes and tomes about scriptural authority and their reasoning and logic and all of that kind of stuff. And he said, oh man, what a tragedy. It's been dissociated. Somehow empiricism seems to be antithetical to religion. We understand why. But he said, if you associate empiricism with religion, he says, I believe that a new era of religion as well as philosophy will be ready to begin. And bear in mind, in modern philosophy, introspection is about as welcome as it is in modern neuroscience or modern psychology. They won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and I've read books by philosophers, one of them called The Disappearance of Introspection. It never happens. There is no such thing as introspection. By, again, he was a big professor at a major university in Ireland. John Searle, who's prominently advocating mind is not reducible to brain, not reducible to brain. Well, quite a renegade. And introspection is impossible. Introspection is impossible. Just rely on the neuroscientists. In other words, it looked like he didn't remember the first thing when he said the second thing. The only way we can understand the mind is with neuroscience, but by the way, the mind is not reducible to the brain. Have you thought through that? Did you see the conclusions? Maybe not. No, and then of course people like Dennett forget about it. He's written a whole book, he's written a whole article on how first-person science is totally impossible. Introspection doesn't happen. It's an illusion anyway. Why bother? And so this is William James's response 110 years ago, you know? So philosophy itself, which is so profoundly non-empirical, anti-empirical, relying on dogma, he's saying associate empiricism, radical empiricism, introspection with religion, with philosophy, and you'll have a whole new era. He says, I fully believe that such an empiricism is a more natural ally than dialectics ever were or can be of the religious life. Go back to experience. And then he went further. There's a German term, Religionswissenschaft, science of religion. I studied it. There's some very fine literature in the field, radically non-empirical, but there it is. William James, of course, he said, well, how about a science of religions? A science of religions, what that might that be like? Well, he defines it. He proposed a science of religion that differs from philosophical theology, which is all about doctrine and concepts, by drawing inferences and devising imperatives based on a scrutiny of what he calls the immediate content of religious experience. So now at least four of you have experienced ghosts, you've told me, seen ghosts, okay? You've experienced altered states of consciousness, many of you. You've experienced lucid dreams. Some of you experienced great, just surging of compassion. Other ones, you know, some of the dark side, depression that comes up seemingly for no reason. You've had a wide variety of it, just in 5 weeks, a wide variety of experience. I've listened to all of you with a lot of interest, right? This, we can say, this is religious experience, a five-weeker, six-weeker, you know. And he's saying, good, why don't we study that? What happens when you devote yourself to religious practice? And all the great religions of the world do have a contemplative current in them, right? So he says, he proposed that we study the immediate content of religious experience. Of course, this is radical imperative now applied to religion. He said, such a science of religion, and not a science of Buddhism or a Buddhist science, but no, a science that's looking at Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, Christianity, and so forth and so on, that's taking the panoramic vision. What's the nature of religious experience? In other words, take his book, Varieties of Religious Experience, and now build on this to make a whole empirical science, truly a science, but a religious experience, a particular bandwidth of first-person experience. Let us take it seriously and let us understand it rather than simply snorting in derision or like this incredibly bigoted statement by an eminent philosopher. Those Christian and Buddhist meditators, they're just, well, okay, they're not hurting anybody, but they're completely wasting their time without probably even ever meeting one, let alone interviewing, without taking any genuine interest. Oh, what a travesty, but I'm not going to go there anymore. So, he said, such a science, a true, empirical, open-minded, unprejudiced science of religion, he said, in quotations, can offer mediation between different believers, people following Christianity, Buddhism, people who are agnostic and atheistic. It can mediation, because it can be science, it can be open-minded, objective, without prejudice as much as possible. It can offer mediation between different believers and help to bring about a consensus of opinion, based upon evidence-based. But taking people's reports of their subjective experience not simply as data, but saying, I understand, this was your experience. That doesn't mean necessarily it's a true experience, but it's your experience. And let's see if other people have replicated that experience. If so, then like the mathematicians that say, this is our experience, this is an outstanding proof, unprecedented proof. If you're studying them and say, well, that's their data, but you don't even take it seriously, well, then you're just a bigot, and you'll never understand mathematics. Or if you just study their brains of mathematicians, you'll never study math. You'll never understand mathematics. It's not data, it's discoveries. And the subjective discoveries and taking place in the minds of mathematicians. And mathematics is the foundation of all of modern science. And it's not objective. I think it's a wonderful irony. And it's not physical. Mathematics, the laws of physics, the laws of mathematics, there's no way possibly they can be construed as physical. They're pre-physical. Right? So, even the personally non-religious might accept its conclusions on trust, much as blind persons now accept the facts of optics. It might appear as foolish to refuse them. Some people are more gifted for religious experience than others. Some people are gifted for lucid dreaming, some for compassion, some for seeing ghosts, some for all kinds of shamatha, vipassana, dzogchen, and so forth. And many people are not. Many people are not practicing. I'm really busy. I'm running a auto parts firm. And so I'm not doing what you're doing, and I don't have your experiences. But I see, whoa, you have a real science there. I think I'd have to be kind of a fool not to accept the conclusions you've drawn, because there are professionals there, as I'm a professional, in selling auto parts. So just as a lot of owners of auto parts stores believe now, for good reason, that there are planets around other stars, even though they're not even a micron close to actually knowing that's true on the basis of their own experience, and they're not going to get there, it's not what they do, but any intelligent auto parts salesman or owner, if he follows the news at all, then he will say, but of course, I have no reason to doubt. I mean, a whole bunch of astronomers, they're people of integrity. They have the mathematics, which I don't understand. They have technology I don't understand. But sure, I accept it. I mean, I'd be a fool not to. Who am I to say they don't have that knowledge? And William James said about that, but that can be true for religious discoveries as well, you know, especially if you approach it in this interreligious, intercontemplative way. He's a revolutionary, but a revolution that never happened. So we come to a conclusion, quite happily, right on time. And so we've looked at ways that science has been co-opted by the dogma and the closed-mindedness, the et cetera, the uncorroborated beliefs of scientific materialism, like a parasite that's sucking the juice out of the scientific community and contaminating the human population. But is there a scientist that could show us, give us a pointer here, how can you get back on track? Because we really lost it. So many assumptions hardly anybody wants to question. Is there a really distinguished scientist? Can you get us back on track? Because we really lost it here. Anybody out there? And then the ghost of Richard Feynman. The ghost of Richard Feynman. He was a pretty big time materialist himself. But Nobel laureate, one of the most brilliant people in the latter part of the 20th century. Richard Feynman from Caltech. He gives this. He said, it is only through refined measurements and careful experimentation that we can have a wider vision. Sounds like he read William James. And of course, when he speaks of measurement and experimentation, he's talking about empiricism, right? He's not saying just thinking. It is only through refined measurements and careful experimentation that we can have a wider vision. And then we see unexpected things. We see things that are far from what we would guess, far from what we could have imagined. If science is to progress, what we need is the ability to experiment, honesty in reporting results. The results must be reported without somebody saying what they would like the results to have been. One of the ways of stopping science would be only to do experiments in the region where you know the law. But experimenters search most diligently and with the greatest effort in exactly those places where it seems most likely that we can prove our theories wrong. In other words, we are trying to prove ourselves wrong as quickly as possible, because only in that way can we find progress. If you said the opposite of everything he just said, that would largely characterize the way the mind science has been operating for the last 100 years. Just say everything the opposite. But that's how science should be doing. That's what science has done. That's what science could be doing. Let me just kind of go back a little bit. And that is that science that is Richard Feynman's vision in terms of the mind sciences, by thinking that that vision, that conception, by thinking that such a conception might be true somewhere, might there be any mind scientists on the planet who are actually doing that? Might it be true? It may be true, even here and now. There may be some young neuroscientist or about to become psychologist, neuroscientist, who would be going in that direction, that total, purely, truly scientific, in the best sense of the term. There may be some here and now, in this room, or listening by podcast. There may be here and now, right? It is fit to be true. That vision is fit to be true. It ought to be true. It must be true. It shall be true for me. So we take William James and apply it to this principle of Richard Feynman. I love it. This is a happy day. And so we end with a quote from Jeffrey Carr, not a well-known name. He's a science editor of The Economist, which is hardly a New Age journal. And he writes, and I quote, "My guess is that we won't really understand consciousness until we have a paradigm shift, that somebody will wake up one morning and say, 'Eureka!' A new wave of thought will then probably emerge, and that will be the basis of a proper theory of consciousness." So I'll end with my footnote. This domination of the natural sciences, and that's physics, biology, psychology, by the uncorroborated assumptions, metaphysical beliefs, the dogma of scientific materialism, I would suggest the fallout from that, the limitation of that, is not confined just to studying the mind-brain-mind-body relationship, but rather the reductionist beliefs of materialism are preventing physicists from making any headway in terms of solving the measurement problem in quantum mechanics. Before you make the measurement, the system exists in the superposition state. You make a measurement, and now the probability wave collapses, and you have actuality. It goes from possibility to actuality by the act of making a measurement. There's no such thing as a measurement without somebody who's making the measurement, a measurer. This clock here is not measuring the table. Right? I am measuring now the density of my head. But the clock is not measuring the table. It's just sitting there, right? So measurement is impossible without consciousness. But that means consciousness must be playing some role in turning actuality into a probability, possibility into actuality. That measurement problem's been around for about 100 years, at least. I would just have to say there's no headway. There's just no progress. I mean, there it is. I mean, it's kind of core to what's the nature of reality, the role of measurement, the role of mind. And there's just no progress at all. I think there's really not much disagreement on that. 100 years. This was the best 100 years we've ever had. And on that point, no progress. Why? Materialism has put their heads in a vice. Get your head out of the vice. How about biology? It's preventing biologists from making any headway in terms of discovering the origins of life. They keep on saying, one day, oh, how about this hypothesis? Oh, we're sure it comes from matter. We're sure it comes from... They don't have a single hypothesis they can test. Not one. They got all these kind of ideas. They're all materialistic, of course. And not one that could be tested. There's not really any clear evidence of making any progress. And why? Got to be inorganic. It's got to be materialistic. Got to be that whole, that business of prana. Oh, that's superstition. What you people experience in your body, it's hallucination. Stop talking about it. It's not scientific. I can't measure it scientifically. It doesn't exist. We don't need prana. Vital energies, vis visa, elan vital, don't need it. Don't talk about it. It gives me the creeps. It's not scientific. It doesn't exist. Okay. Then have another 100 years of not knowing about the origin of life. And then, of course, these beliefs have been preventing, for the last 125, 35 years, mind scientists, cognitive scientists, from understanding consciousness. They don't even know how to define it. They can't measure it. They don't know what caused it. They don't know whether it's causal efficacy. They don't know how it interfaces with the mind, brain. They don't know what happens at death. I mean, really, the ignorance of consciousness is pretty much 100%. And it will remain 100% as long as they stay in the same box they're in now. And what's the role of the mind in human existence? What's the role of mind in the natural world? No progress at all, really. No progress at all. In terms of understanding the nature of mental events and how they relate to the physical. None at all. Because they have illusions of knowledge. They're pretending as if they already know what they don't know. They don't know the nature of the correlations. They're simply assuming, okay, the mind is the brain. or the mind produces the brain. And that's the end of the conversation. We don't need any more alternatives, thanks very much. We're going to work only within those paradigms. And so the materialistic dogma has been inhibiting the imagination for physics, biology, and psychology for 100 years, 150 years. And we're making no progress in some of the core issues about the nature of the universe, human existence, genuine happiness, the reality of suffering and its sources. So maybe enough is enough. Enough is enough. So what I'm calling for is something rather modest. What I'm suggesting is that we need a Protestant Reformation against the Church scientific to free science from the ideological tyranny of scientific materialism. So a Protestant Reformation against the Church scientific, a term coined about 150 years ago. That's just one. Protestant Reformation. We need a new Protestant Reformation with all the passion of Luther, but now to the new church that's just as tyrannical and dogmatic as the old church 400, 500 years ago. That's one. That's what my first wish list. Dear Santa, I would like to see that. Secondly, I'd like to see the first revolution in the mind sciences. We've never had one for very good reason. It's completely got its head buried in dogma. We've had two revolutions in physics, one revolution in biology, zero for the mind sciences, because they won't budge. And so may there be the first revolution fundamentally questioning the deepest assumptions for the first time in under 35 years. May there be the first true revolution in the mind sciences. That's my second. Dear Santa, that's my second one. That's what I want for Christmas. And the third one is a renaissance, a true renaissance of contemplative inquiry in all the great religious traditions of the world. They've all got them. I mean, you go through the list, the Kabbalah and the Jewish tradition, Taoist tradition in spades, Hinduism all over the place, Buddhism, of course, Christianity, big time, and there are others as well. But those are some of the big ones right there. They all have it, but they're all buried, like put back in the drawer. You don't even look at it. It's just collecting dust for the most part. True contemplative inquiry, not just doing your rituals, your visualization, your prayers, your chanting, your faith, your all of that. It's all very wise. I have no problem. Do all that. But when you do contemplative inquiry already, also, you have the methods, you have the lineage, you have the tradition, you have wisdom. Why don't you draw on your own wisdom? Let's have a renaissance, a rebirth of contemplative inquiry in all the great religious traditions of the world. Then we'll have a basis for having a science of religions that can join hand in hand with the science of the mind, the science of physics, the science of biology, to the enrichment of all. So that's all I want. A Protestant Reformation, a scientific revolution, and a renaissance. You notice I like three R's. That's all. So, hello, podcast people. That's what I want for Christmas. I don't need any more chocolate, thank you. I've been getting lots of chocolate. I'm set for chocolate. Now I just want Protestant Reformation, or revolution, and renaissance. Thank you, and good night.